Today on the 21st show, on any given day, nearly 15,000 of our fellow Illinoisans are homeless. That's a tough way to live all year, but especially when the weather is extreme, as it was this past weekend. Not to mention that we're in a period when government funding is in flux. We'll talk with the state's homelessness chief and others who work in the field about what's happening and what we can do to address one of the most persistent problems faced by people in our society. I'm Brian Mackey, and that's coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WNIJ in Rockford DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. On any given day, it's estimated nearly 15,000 of our fellow Illinoisans are homeless. Those statistics come from the Illinois Department of Human Services. Homelessness is not a new problem, but its scale has grown in recent years, even as states like Illinois embrace active efforts to bring down homelessness, or at least try to help those who are homeless stay healthy and safe, especially in extreme conditions like the weather most of Illinois has been experiencing these past few days and is expected to experience for much of this week. That increase in homelessness has strained some of the organizations that try to help. And on top of that, there are worries that federal policy changes under the Trump administration meant to promote self-sufficiency could raise the barriers for people who seek out help. We're going to talk today for the rest of the hour about what's happening with this all across the 21st state and what comes next. Joining me now is Christine Haley, the state homelessness chief in the Illinois Office to Prevent and End Homelessness. She's been in that position since not long after it was created, back in 2021. Before that, she had worked for several years on housing issues in government and the private sector. Christine, welcome back to the 21st Show.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Molly Brown is associate professor in psychology at DePaul University in Chicago, and she's director of the Homelessness Advocacy Research and Collaboration Lab there. Molly, welcome to you as well.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
The Reverend Dwight Ford is executive director for Project Now, a nonprofit based in the Quad Cities. One of its focuses are services for people who are homeless. Reverend Ford, welcome back to the 21st Show to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And Tanishkia Wright is executive director of the Carbondale Warming Center, a homeless shelter in southern Illinois. Tanishkia, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Listeners, our phone lines are open throughout the hour today if you want to join our conversation at 800-222-9455. How do you think Illinois is doing in the fight against homelessness? What do you think are some of the causes of homelessness? And do you think our policies around homelessness are on the right track or the wrong track? 800-222-9455 is the number. All right, before we get into facts and figures, it's been so cold and so snowy in parts of Illinois. Reverend Ford, I'm going to start with you. What was this weekend like for people who are homeless in the Quad Cities?
Thank you. Much better. We were able to finally get off the ground our winter overflow shelter, which had been drastically delayed because of a moratorium on new homeless shelters and also an ordinance that was very restrictive in the city that we hosted our low barrier winter overflow shelter last year. And so we were finally able to get it off the ground. We did in the past, maybe about 3 weeks ago, when we had another one of these kind of ugly, brutal blast of cold weather, and we wanted to be prepared for this one, and we were able to get it off the ground just last Wednesday. And so we ran straight through the weekend without interruption, and the individuals were not asked to leave, and to be able to house over 60 people in the Low Bear Winter Overflow Shelter, it was remarkably well run, but also very much appreciative by the people that we serve. And so it was a much better weekend. We have a long way to go, but just to get this into place, we have a fighting chance now.
Tanishka writes, same question to you. You all had more than a foot of snow in Carbondale. What was the weekend like there for people who are homeless?
Yes, so we've not had this much snow in a while. Well, our shelter was normally open 24, was used to be open 24/7, but we have been open for 12 hours only for a few days. So this weekend, I made a decision just to open up throughout the snow for 24/7. We don't have as many shelters as we would like to have down here. We are one of the low barrier shelters in Southern Illinois. So we don't require much for anyone to come into our shelter. And in our region, our homelessness has grown. And during this snow, hopefully half of the encampments that we have around the city, I hope that they had got into someplace warm. So we did open our doors 24/7 though for the next 7 days.
All right, so that's the sort of the acute situation, what happened this weekend. Let's take a step back now and look at the sort of overall picture. Christine Haley, State Homelessness Chief, where does Illinois stand now? You know, you and I last talked on this program, I believe in 2023, about this topic. Where does Illinois stand now compared to a few years ago?
I think it's important for us to ground this conversation in our homes. So ending homelessness is really about everyone in our state having a home. So having an apartment or a house and a safe place to sleep at night. And our homes are a basic need, just like we need food to eat and clean air to breathe and clean water to drink. So I think that we understand clearly that homelessness is a statewide issue. About half of all people in Illinois experiencing homelessness live outside of Chicago. So we see homelessness in suburban areas and rural areas across the state, from Moline to Marion, from Quincy to Cairo. And at its core, homelessness is rooted in the dynamics of the housing market, right? Which includes rising rents, it includes limited housing supply, it includes wages that have not kept pace with housing costs. So if we look at the data, we see that on any given day, as you said, there's close to 1,500 people who experience literal homelessness, meaning those that live on the street, those that live in a shelter, those that are fleeing domestic violence.
15,000, just to be clear. Yeah.
It's about 14,571 is our best estimate for those who are experiencing literal homelessness. So we've seen an increase in unsheltered homelessness between the years 2020 and 2024 by about 14%. But we've actually seen decreases in homelessness in multiple, in 11 out of our 19 community areas.
To what do you attribute that?
So I think that we first look at rent costs and rent prices. And we see from 2020 to 2024 that there were increases in rent across our state of upwards of 40% in some areas. But almost every piece of our state, we've seen increases in rent. So from that 2024 count, our point in time counts where folks, you know, go out and do a direct count in these winter months of the number of people who are experiencing homelessness on any given day. We did see that decrease from a January of 2024 to January of 2025. So we looked at our rental costs, and we have not seen reductions from 2024 to 2025. So we do believe that the investments that we have made at the state level, where we have more than doubled the investments in ending homelessness, have had a key impact on seeing those reductions.
Molly Brown, I want to bring you into the conversation now. Again, psychology professor at DePaul, director of the Homelessness Advocacy Research and Collaboration Lab. What do we know about who is homeless among our fellow Illinoisans?
Great question. Homelessness affects people from all walks of life, all demographics. But some key populations that, you know, we need to pay particular attention to are actually older adults. Older adults who are age 55 and older comprise about 20% of the national unhoused population, and they also represent the fastest growing segment of the homeless population nationally. So you can imagine older adults and the particular vulnerabilities that they might have when facing the elements and stressors and traumas associated with homelessness. And this is largely driven due to the nature of having a fixed income, increasing healthcare costs, and those factors that particularly impact older adults. Homelessness is also an issue of racism and racial discrimination, where Black individuals nationally comprise about a third of the overall unhoused population, which is a huge overrepresentation compared to the national population. We see those trends kind of mirrored in the state of Illinois as well. And we're also seeing increases in the prevalence of people who experience long-standing chronic patterns of homelessness, who now comprise about a third of the overall unhoused population nationally, and it's continuing to be on the rise. And that suggests that individuals are having more and more difficulty exiting homelessness once they become unhoused. So there are a lot of kind of key vulnerable populations that will require some special attention at the policy level.
And we've talked a little bit about some of these, the numbers, the official counts, right? 14,571 on any given day. What do those counts get right? What do they perhaps miss sometimes?
A big there's a big movement to call attention to the limitations of the current way the federal government measures homelessness, which is based on rates of street and shelter homelessness and people who are living in uninhabitable locations outside. That is a pretty narrow scope when we're trying to understand who truly doesn't have a stable place to live in our state and in our country. And misses a huge invisible majority of people who live in doubled up situations. For example, in the state of Illinois, an estimated 75 people out of every 10,000 are living in doubled up situations. They don't have a place to call their own. They're living temporarily under somebody else's roof. And these are folks who have an extremely high vulnerability to then entering the homeless service system. And these are folks who oftentimes don't get access to the types of housing support services that we offer in our state. And so they're living kind of in this precarious situation. There's also a huge segment of folks who are housing insecure due to being severely rent burdened. There's about 75% of people who are extremely low income in the state of Illinois that spend at least 50% of their income on rent. And so you can imagine that any little financial emergency that would come up for those folks could eventually lead them to become unhoused. So there's a lot of folks that just aren't fully being captured in this picture in identifying what the housing need is in our society.
Well, that puts me in mind of a text message we got from a listener. And let me remind listeners, you can join our texting group by sending the word talk to 217-803-0730. But Amy in Wakanda, Illinois says, "My friend rides the hairline between housed and unhoused year to year. As she calls around, she's told time and again by agencies that they are ostensibly there to help people, that we can't help you avoid homelessness until you're on the street. Call us back when you're in a shelter." Amy says her friend has a child in middle school. She has, furniture, clothing, important documents she'd like to not lose. What she needs is income-assisted housing, but to get there, you need to be at the bottom, Amy says. More funding would help keep people from becoming homeless, and frankly, that's what tax dollars are for. Amy, thank you for sharing that message. Christine Haley, what do you say to that? What do you tell people like Amy's friend?
Sure. So I think that at one sense is that we have not funded the interventions that we know that work at scale, right? So within the homelessness system, there are a number of interventions that are utilized across the spectrum. For folks that are not yet in a sheltered situation, the opportunities lie within public housing authorities to apply for affordable housing subsidies, like housing choice vouchers or other site-based public housing at the county level. I think we also invest in two programs at the state level around prevention to help people prevent losing their homes. So the first is around homeless prevention. So that's targeted at people who have had a housing crisis, are still in their apartment, and that are at risk, however, of not being able to pay due to an emergency. So we invest in homeless prevention. We also invest in what we call court-based rental assistance programs. So Illinois is one of the few states that continued the court-based rental assistance program that was created at the federal level during COVID to support people who were in eviction court. So it provides support to folks that to pay back private market landlords on rental arrears. It can also support some legal costs. And in those two interventions, that's what we think about as it relates to prevention, because as you think about in healthcare and other areas that the that we think about prevention as being key. But at the end of the day, what will keep folks housed is affordable housing. And we are nationally at have a lack of affordable housing. We have a lack of affordable housing here in the state of Illinois, across communities across the state. And so I think that what the listeners is asking for is, how can we create more affordable communities all across the state? And I think that will take investments in local municipalities and prioritizing the development of affordable housing in partnership with state and federal resources to create more affordable housing. And will also require communities to embrace and want affordable housing in their community. So I think
those I'm sorry to interrupt you, because we need to take a break. That is actually a great tease for somewhere we can go as soon as we get back from our break, about how local communities do respond to attempts to increase housing and even just increasing shelters. We're going to talk about that. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455. Homelessness is our topic for the hour. This is The 21st Show. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking for the hour today about the state of homelessness in Illinois. Coming out of a weekend of weather, really in a week of weather, that has left people who are homeless particularly vulnerable. We're also talking about how our resources to help those people are holding up and what comes next. We heard from our listeners in our texting group about this. Jesse and Mattoon said the main cause is wages suck. Sorry, quoting Jesse here. And it's easier to give up than try to fit in with the middle class. Soul searching is so badly needed, Jesse said. Also, Christopher in Brimfield told us it's amazing that America can spend trillions of dollars on AI, but can't afford to help its citizens. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455 is the number to call in live. 800-222-9455. Our guests are Tanishkia Wright with the Carbondale Warming Center, Reverend Dwight Ford with Project Now in the Quad Cities, Molly Brown at DePaul University, and Christine Haley, the state's homelessness chief. Again, 800-222-9455 to join us. Reverend Ford, I want to come back to you, because Project Now recently partnered with the city of Moline to open a winter emergency shelter. I understand this has been a long time coming. Talk about the back and forth with local governments to try to make this happen.
Well, thank you. The city of Rock Island is where we're headquartered, and last year we were very appreciative of the opportunity to step in and facilitate the winter overflow shelter in the same city we're headquartered in. But we serve all of Rock Island County, Mercer and Henry. And the effort ran into a major set of roadblocks here, some not in my backyard kind of realities. A certain set of business owners, although we believe it was only two that were vocal, that came out and kind of pressed that we had too many of these type of agencies serving poor folks downtown, and so unfortunate, so that the ward alderman went on record and in the paper said, I don't want my ward to become a social service ghetto. And so when you have that kind of animus, it wasn't a mystery why we looked up and there was an immediate moratorium placed in July that went all the way, was scheduled for in November. And we normally open up the winter overflow shelter December 1st, if given an opportunity here. So that was jammed up because we ended up having to fight and exercise political self-defense for the people that we serve all the way through the moratorium phase. And then rolled out of the moratorium was an ordinance. And that ordinance banned and barred everything from drug rehab centers and service agencies like myself, food pantries, and any 1,000-foot radius or distance from an existing service provider, a park, a river, a daycare center, a school. It was done with such precision, there was not another space in the entire city of Rock Island where we could have found a home. And so we started quietly and consistently negotiating with other cities. They welcomed us. But you know how it takes a while to find a space that could pass fire codes as well. But you also have to think about where it's located in that city. It was so public that we didn't want cities to get apprehensive and say, my God, we don't want that in our city with all of that. So we had to keep up the press and fight, but we also had to work in a negotiable way with other cities that were welcoming to the idea, but wanted to quietly go through their own process. And Moline and our agency had a longstanding history. And so we were able to hammer this out and get it off the ground. What a wonderful mayoral commitment, city council, the staffers were just great to work with in the city. But we know that this is just the first week. We are looking to adjust ourselves to the environment. There are things that we learned in last season, so much so of how to work in on the relationships with the local business owners. So we put in a Good Neighbors Initiative where our team went out three times a day engaging businesses, communities, and just making sure that if they had guests that maybe needed some support, that we would get the first call and not jam up police departments or call city council. We also learned that this was an effort that we could utilize a warming center. So last year we opened up our headquarters building for a warming center. So we were open up 22 hours a day to be able to house them overnight and then shelter them overnight, then serve them in the morning and move people up and out through case management. But that's a long process. We built relationships and moved over that season. In 12 weeks running, we moved 14 to stable, adequate housing that that they're still in today. And so we're very proud of that great effort. We are learning how to put those same measures in place at this location. We have another warming day center that allows us to do case management as well, wraparound services. But I want to go back to what Chief Haley said. It is the great effort of providing supports. And even with Moline, we do a level up program that allows us to make a $400 investment to Moline residents a month for 31 families to keep them secure. These families have been identified as housing vulnerable. And so we make those investments to keep them housed. And then we have another pot of almost $65,000 that allows us to invest up to $2,000 for any one-time emergency. As many folks know, 51% of Americans can't afford a $400 emergency any one day of the year. And then we have LIHEAP, so Low Income Home Energy Assistance Program. Right now, we're about 4,200 households served. The average benefit is almost $920. And you know what that does for the household to be able to stay stable. And then finally, the wraparound services of an eviction diversion court that we have here, the eviction diversion program, we put it together with the 14th Judicial Court Circuit, Rock Island County Bar Association, John Deere attorneys were with us, also Perry State Legal Aid, and also Salvation Army. And we went from 14 evictions almost on a Friday down to 2 and 3. And even when people are evicted, their evictions are sealed. We move money. All of them are assigned to us at the first hearing. So we negotiate immediately. But it takes all of those kind of efforts. And we still have a ballooning number that is out of control in the Quad Cities. But we're throwing everything we can at it.
All right, let me remind people this is the 21st show. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455. And let's go now to Linda, who is calling from Murfreesboro, Illinois. Linda, thank you for calling in.
I'm glad to hear that there's another opportunity down here in southern Illinois, at least for a week. I had an experience trying to find shelter for in inclement weather for the same person three times. One opportunity was completely full, and the other one it was only open, 12 hours a day, as we've heard previously from one of your guests. So, and other groups that purport to help are only open Monday through Thursday. You can't reach anybody on Friday. You couldn't reach anyone on Veterans Day, for example, as though homelessness ends on Friday and on holidays. And then, when some shelters try to find opportunity in bigger facilities for more people, they run into this NIMBY business, not in my backyard. So it is a very difficult problem, and we definitely need more opportunities down here in southern Illinois.
All right, Linda, thank you for sharing that. I appreciate it. Tanishkia, let me bring you back into the conversation now. Tanishkia Wright with the Carbondale Warming Center. I understand funding has been a challenge. Talk to me about that. Where does the center get its funding? And
so, yes, some of it has. Yeah, I've been with the Carbondale Warming Center for about 6 years. I do know we just started out as a warming center. Then COVID hit, which transitioned us into a 24-hour shelter. We had received emergency funding through the state and federal government and through our city for those couple of years. So then when that funding run out, we are strictly donation based. We have transitioned from one director to the other, which my previous director has left. I am the director now. And I'm not really have a lot of education in grant writing. So I'm learning as I go right now, as far as, trying to get grants to help support the warming center. Yes, so with us going to 12 hours, we were like the one-all fits-all for most of our unhoused, because we were housing at least 80 people during this time of the year for 24/7. And we have dropped down to like 25 people that I can house in my building. One, my building is unsound, and this will be our last winter in it. We are trying to get funding to find a new building or solicit to the city to find us a building, however that may be. We don't want to have to close our doors completely, because most of our unhoused community do depend on the warming center, because we are a low barrier shelter. Only thing we require is that you cannot be a sex offender to enter our doors. We don't do any drug testing or anything to hinder them, because we're trying to meet them where they are. And it was so unfortunate that we had to be closed down and only for 12 hours. So that really did do a disservice to our community, because Carbondale is like a central hub for all the lower communities. There is no shelter in Alexander, Pulaski, or, Massac County, these counties that are under us. So everybody kind of migrates to Carbondale. So we had an opportunity to acquire a building that was donated to one of our shelters. But like she said, the NIMBY things got in the way. And then our city council is totally against with moving the shelter to this particular side of town. It was just a lot of things that I didn't even foresee that was happening in the background, that people were really against moving the shelter from where it is right now over there, which the building that was donated is an old church. It is definitely sound. Myself, the Carbondale Warming Center, and Good Sam could have occupied the building. But now we're back to square one, trying to find a building for us. I don't know exactly what Good Sam is doing, but we are trying to maybe start a capital campaign into creating a facility for the southern region. That's what I'm trying to do. I'm not sure, on the back end, but like Reverend Dwight Ford said, it is a lot. And we are really trying to kind of model you guys, for the southern region to kind of have all of the counties chip in for this facility that I would think, because it would be housing most of our vulnerable in our communities, our southern communities.
Maybe this is a good point to add. Professor Molly Brown with DePaul University. What we've heard a lot about this NIMBY, right? Not in my backyard. What works in terms of communities and agencies like the ones we've been talking with today in terms of trying to overcome that attitude?
Well, I really admire the work that's being done to advocate for the expansion of services to ensure that as many people in our local communities get served as possible. In terms of combating NIMBYism, messaging is key. So we've seen in recent years polling around public attitudes toward homelessness have actually kind of increased in their recognition that homelessness is caused by structural and economic factors and not so much by individual level deficits or causes for homelessness that have been so stigmatizing toward people historically. One thing I do worry about is going to be the impact of federal level policies and messaging coming from our federal government that is now seeking to kind of take us back in time by conflating homelessness, mental illness, and crime and disorder in our public spaces. And that's just going to create more and more of a sentiment that we need to be afraid and not have unhoused people in our communities and kind of fuel those NIMBY attitudes. So the more we can do to educate the public about the true root causes of homelessness, to humanize the experience of homelessness and to recognize that homelessness impacts people from all walks of life. And also dispel myths around the crime and disorder that tend to be ascribed to people who are unhoused, and recognizing that these are individuals who are less likely to commit violent crime compared to the general population of housed folks. So I think the more we can do around public messaging that combats those stigmatizing attitudes is really going to be critical.
Well, that is a key thing, right? That difference between crime and disorder, and people see tent encampments and their mind thinks crime, and and maybe it is. It does seem disorderly, right? It points at something that our society is really failing at. I mean, what do you say to people who say it is, it's maybe it's reasonable to not want a homeless shelter in their neighborhood? What is the message to those people?
Well, I think you'd want to sort of question the alternative then. If a person doesn't want a homeless shelter in their community, would they then support policies that would promote affordable housing and homelessness prevention opportunities to address the homelessness issue in their that's affecting their local area? And help folks kind of understand, the true solution to this is not to push individuals out into the fringes of society, where they'll be less safe and, be at greater risk of harm and health concerns. But instead providing people a welcoming community where they can get services and hopefully get connected with more permanent housing opportunities. I think helping connect the dots for people can be helpful in that.
Yeah, the quote I've been thinking of a lot in many, many issues is there are no solutions, only trade-offs. And it's worth thinking of those trade-offs here. All right, let me remind listeners, this is the 21st show. We are talking about the state of homelessness in Illinois. Nearly 15,000 of our fellow Illinoisans are homeless on any given day. We're talking about that with DePaul University Professor Molly Brown, the Reverend Dwight Ford with Project Now in the Quad Cities, Tanishkia Wright with the Carbondale Warming Center, and Christine Haley, who is the state of Illinois' homelessness chief. 800-222-9455 if you want to join us today. We are going to talk about the some of the big picture issues and policy goals here, this idea of functional zero homelessness in Illinois as a goal and where we are on trying to achieve that. When we return, again, if you want to join us, 800-222-9455. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about homelessness in Illinois, who's experiencing it, what communities are doing about it, and what the future holds. My guests today are Molly Brown, who is a professor in psychology at DePaul University and director of the Homelessness Advocacy Research and Collaboration Lab there. The Reverend Dwight Ford, executive director of Project Now in the Quad Cities. Tanishkia Wright, executive director of the Carbondale Warming Center. And Christine Haley, who's with the Illinois Department of Human Services. She is the state's homelessness chief. And Christine Haley, when we last spoke in 2023, we talked about that goal Illinois has of reaching functional zero homelessness. And the idea, just to remind listeners, is that, you know, when homelessness does happen, it's rare, it's brief, it doesn't recur. There may always be some, you know, aspects of people experiencing difficulties that lead to homelessness in life. But what would it take to get from where we are today to making functional zero homelessness a reality?
Mm-hmm. Well, where we are today is that if we look at our statewide 211 data, that the number one reason why people call for support is for housing. So it's the number one concern that Illinoisans have, followed by the number two concern is around utilities. So again, another housing related cost. I think that what we've done over the past few years is really build an infrastructure within state government to address homelessness. So back in 2021, Governor Pritzker signed an executive order to fight homelessness that laid out this vision for us statewide to ensure that we have a safety net that supports those when they are at risk of homelessness, that there is a shelter system that we can count on and rely on when someone is unable to avoid a homelessness situation. And then the third is really building up our affordable housing stock. And I think part of what Professor Brown was talking about was really the need for us to pull back and recognize that homelessness is not about individual choices. It's not about bad decision making, but it's really about what are the structural pieces that need to be in place in order for families to thrive in housing. And that it is at its core a structural issue due to the lack of affordable housing. So when we think about functional zero, we've seen that there are communities across our state that have reached functional zero for veterans, including Rockford, including Lake County, right? So we do have examples where this is absolutely an attainable goal. And it's attainable because we understand what are the interventions that work. First, we need to ensure that we have, that people know how to access prevention funding, and that funding is available at scale. Currently, it isn't at scale, but we do have prevention providers statewide. The second is understanding how we invest in shelter, and we know and understand that we haven't invested in shelter at scale. However, we have grown our state budget in funding shelter from a $10 million before Home in Illinois to now over $100 million, which is within Home Illinois, which is Governor Pritzker's signature investment in ending homelessness. The third piece is that we need to create a housing infrastructure that has an array of housing options for people across the housing spectrum. For those who are disabled and unable to work and have some of the lowest incomes, to those who are working and still experiencing homelessness. I think part of the myth busting is understanding that there are people who work full-time jobs that cannot afford a full-time home. And so we are really looking at understanding how do we continue to develop the pipeline of housing needed to support folks, and also the workforce opportunities. We currently have a pilot project with the Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunities, and looking at how to better connect homeless systems and workforce systems. And finally, I think it's the piece of how are we bringing in municipal leaders? How are we bringing in the community to say yes to housing developments that support folks that are unhoused? I think part of our challenge is that we see that we make investments in supporting people who are experiencing homelessness through the healthcare system. So in Illinois, the average age of death of a person who is experiencing homelessness in our state is 56 years old. And we spend about $3 billion in funding for healthcare for people who are unhoused. But our budget for housing is nowhere close to that, right? So how do we really think about bringing in healthcare, bringing in folks who have experienced homelessness themselves to the table to make decisions? And ultimately, it's, I think, all of our jobs to dispel the myths that homelessness is caused by personal decision making, but really it's caused by the lack of affordable housing in our communities.
Molly Brown, what approaches? We heard there that, you know, Rockford has had success with functional zero homelessness among veterans. What sort of approaches or solutions have you seen in other places that show the most promise?
Well, the most promise really has to do with ensuring that we have, I think Chief Haley already spoke to this a little bit, but having an array of different services available to meet the different needs of the unhoused population. One type of intervention that is currently under threat by the federal government are what are called Housing First, or a type of permanent supportive housing programs that are evidence-based models for providing permanent affordable housing with wraparound support services for a subset of the unhoused community that experiences mental illness and substance use disorders, and provides a really critical opportunity for stability and care and recovery for that population. These models are predicated on the idea that we want to provide people housing without preconditions for compliance with treatment. And once a person is stably housed, they get services and can start their recovery process at that point. But our federal government is really putting pressure on local communities to kind of take us back to a more traditional model that was already shown to be ineffective, where people essentially have to be self-sufficient and compliant with treatment requirements in order to get housing, and making the housing contingent on their compliance, which, as you can imagine, just strips away an individual's choice and agency in how they want to conduct their lives. So there's a wealth of research that has shown that the Housing First model promotes long-term housing outcomes for people who have a lot of barriers to housing. And this is on the national and international level. And so I think the more we can do to protect those supportive housing resources at the state level as much as we can, and kind of use our power as a state to kind of keep those resources available for folks, that's really going to help kind of promote our long-term success.
Tanishka Wright with the Carbondale Warming Center. How have you felt, you know, in being able to guide people to other resources as you have been, you know, dealing with the reduced funding and the challenges at the Warming Center?
So right now in our community, a lot of our resources that we have, a lot of the people that I've been serving have a lot of mental health and substance abuse right now. And them getting the services that they need is not happening. It's almost like for an example, if I got some substance abuse or mental health issues and I need help with a particular group, I'll say Centerstone, for an example. If I can't keep my appointment, meaning I don't, just something as silly as making a phone call. Well, I'm homeless. I don't have a phone, so I can't make the phone call. So then they are dropped and I have to start a process all over again. So that's what I've been kind of seeing. Or if they decide they want to go to a rehab and decide not to go or something, then they're dropped again. And then it's the process starts all over again. So we do have a group called Take Action Today right now that is kind of trying to facilitate those things with the mental health and the substance abuse. And that's all that the center can do is kind of just guide them to our mental health advocates, Take Action Today, and Southern Illinois Coalition for Homelessness. But sometimes during those intakes or those processes, they get thrown, by the wayside because they didn't meet some requirement. So that's what we're experiencing right now.
And Reverend Dwight Ford with Project Now in the Quad Cities, you talked about, we've talked about the sort of short-term needs of the shelter that you were able to open, also moving people into more permanent housing. What is next? What is Project Now doing to try and take that, longer-term approach to dealing with homelessness?
We're building an entire continuum of housing services. Of course, the shelter network is the first and most important station because it allows us to not only secure individuals and families, but it allows us to actually save a human life. I think people forget that that not just with these temperatures, but the expectancy of life and the additional challenges that individuals have. Right now, our shelter just opened up, and our youngest has been 2 months. Our oldest has been 81 years old. So you're talking about people on the spectrum, and caught on the bookends of life that are very vulnerable. And our largest category of people unhoused, at least from last year to this year, about 70% of them are between 25 and 54. We want to secure what the shelter, but now to do the wraparound services to move up and out. We served 180 people last year, average of 26 a night. We fought to make sure we had 14 housed. We're already working on those numbers. The next is to make sure we have enough affordable rental property. That's the major effort that we have going on now. We've been bringing in specialists to talk about tiny homes, multiplexes, duplexes, shared housing realities, anything that we can think of to put it on the grid for consideration, zoning challenges, and how do we work through them with municipalities. But all of this, right now, we're 6,645 units short of affordable rental properties. And when you have evictions, and because we're bi-state, we know that there is a reality when people get evicted from one state, they move to the next, they go where the opportunities are. We have to solve this in a regional reality for us here in the Quad Cities. Then after that, we are really building in the sincere hopes to do turnkey operations, build security in folks over a period of time, and that they have been renting down the house or home or tiny house becomes theirs. And then, of course, home ownership. We're working for a permanent housing or a permanent shelter in the city of Moline right now. We're already planning. This is temporary. It gets us to April 15th, but we've already started plans for a long-term campus reality so I could bring all of our wraparound services to one spot, including addiction services and mental health services as well. We've already have been able to get 18 people their mental health evaluations to help them secure medications or get back onto the medications because they were interrupted during that season of homelessness. So we're fighting with everything. I think what's most important for us is that we simply start with an empathy that cares. Hannah Arendt said the death of human empathy is one of the earliest and most telling signs of a culture that is almost ready to fall into barbarism. Eyes and ears are poor witnesses when the soul is already barbarous. That's what Heraclitus said. We got to keep people fully human to care about one another. And the tide is turning, the effort is pushing, but we need more personal responsibility to get in the fight, better and more public will, and then we'll get a better set of public policy. But the fight continues.
Reverend Dwight Ford, Tanishq Wright, Christine Haley and Molly Brown, thank you so much for being with us and sharing your perspectives with us today here on the 21st Show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
That's all the time for us today. Coming up tomorrow on the program, another conversation with a candidate for the United States Senate, Democrat Brian Maxwell, an environmental research scientist. You can let us know what questions you have for him and other candidates. Our voicemail line is 217-300-2121. I should also say we're taking questions for a candidate for governor. We're speaking on Wednesday with Ted Dabrowski, running for the Republican nomination. The voicemail line again is 217-300-2121. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Colson Khan. Technical direction and engineering from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick's our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.